Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Cheeky Natives. This is Alma Nelisha Gcwele and I am...
Doctor.
She always makes this correction. Doctor Alma Nelisha Gcwele. I've had a long day of doctoring, so I'm actually okay with not. We have Letlokgo Nolo, who is the other half of the Cheeky Natives
Hello.
Here with us. And we have a wonderful guest. So stop saying special, because I say this about every guest. So I'm just trying to expand my vocabulary a little bit now. We have a wonderful guest in studio with us today, Carnita Loxton, who is the author of Being Lily.
And also the author of Being Carrie, right, which is the book that she wrote last year, and Being Lily is a sequel to that book. So I think we're just going to spend a little bit giving an introduction. Mm-hmm. It's like Carnita Loxton was born in Cape Town, studied law at the UCT, and worked as an attorney, predominantly in the financial services industry. Obviously, we're going to talk about that. More recently, she has trained and worked as an executive coach. Her first novel, Being Carrie, was longlisted for the 2018 Nine Mobile Prize for Literature and shortlisted for the 2018 Herman Charles Bosman Prize. Being Lily is a sequel to her debut novel. Hi, Juanita.
Hello. Thank you for talking to me.
How are you doing?
To have
I'm
you.
Doing well.
We see you flew in from Cape Town yesterday. Yes. How's that going?
Yeah, it's going well. I'm really enjoying it. It's hot here. No one told Cape Town that it was time for summer. So I arrived here in a puffer jacket and now I'm sitting here in a tank top. So it's fantastic.
And how has your day been? I understand that today you went to do an interview.
I had an interview, so I've just got back there. Traffic was crazy.
Welcome to Joburg.
Shout out to Joburg.
Bit of a shock. Cape Town traffic is... also quite special, if I can use that word. But yeah, I think Joburg might have something on us.
Oh, okay. So this is your second book. Your first novel was called Being Carrie.
Mm-hmm.
And it was published last year.
Yes.
And that was your debut.
It was. Yes.
And it's been so well received. It's been long listed for the Herman Bosman Prize. And just a couple of other awards. So what's the transition been like from being a debut novel to now your sophomore novel?
Well, it's... I can't really tell the difference because it all happened so quickly, to tell you the truth. So it just feels like an extension of Being Carrie for me, which has been wonderful. I haven't had time to really stop and think about it. But everyone that I've met, from fellow writers to readers, have been very welcoming and very warm towards me. So it's been a fantastic experience. And for me also, coming from having trained in law and having had a career there, to start over in something new in my 40s, it's quite a special thing, because I think we so rarely get an opportunity almost to start over, to be new at something. So that whole feeling of being new, it's like doing articles all over again.
And why the change, right? So you come from a very, you know, what people would call the noble profession. Why the change from law, particularly in the financial sector, to becoming a full-time writer?
It wasn't that conscious a decision, because I practiced law and I worked for Sanlam for many years. And then I had my oldest son, he's now 11, and I had this idea that I was going to do everything. So I was going to be this fantastic hotshot lawyer, and I was going to be this amazing mum and all of that. And then I came to my senses a little bit, and I did work as a freelance attorney, I'm not sure what, as a consultant.
Yes,
I've already forgotten the terminology, but I was a consultant for a long time. And I didn't enjoy it as much as being a lawyer inside a business, because I found that inside a business I really enjoyed the day-to-day activity and I enjoyed working with people, and I enjoyed that, I guess, creative part of being a lawyer, where you solve problems pragmatically, and you know, that kind of, it really spoke to me. Being a consultant was quite different. It's kind of, you know, people send you emails, you do the stuff, you send it back. There wasn't the same satisfaction in it for me. And I'd always written little bits as a growing up, but it was more sort of observational stuff for myself. But having that gap and looking for something creative led me into creative writing and was learning that as a craft. But it wasn't ever with the intention of becoming a writer. It was sort of, I guess, when you've got a little baby, survival and sanity. So it's come almost by accident.
And then how did you end up publishing? So how did you move from it being something that you just did, yeah, you know, as a creative outlet, to publishing being Kari? What was the inspiration behind it? Yeah. And for people who haven't read the book,
yeah,
can you just give them a little bit of an idea about what being Kari is about?
Okay, so the journey to doing a novel in itself was quite a one of luck, actually. It's quite an extraordinary story for me, even when I tell it, mm-hmm, is that I found an online sort of 8-week creative writing course where you practice different styles of writing, and it was run at the time through Get Smarter, but Mike Nichol was the one of the conveners there. And I did it, and I loved it, because it taught me how to write, mm-hmm, in a sense. Not how to write, is putting it too simplistically, but how to build a character, how to do those kind of things. And I loved it. But when the 8 weeks were done, it was done. I thought, yeah, that was quite an interesting experience, and let it go. And then I had dinner, just coincidentally, with an editor called Claire Strombeck, who also worked with Mike on this online course. And she said to me, don't you want to try and write a novel? And I laughed at her, as you would at the beginning of a dinner when somebody says that, mm-hmm, to you. And she said, because we're doing a masterclass where you come up with an idea for a novel, and every month you send us however many thousand words you've written, and we have a look at it, and we give you feedback, and the idea is by the end of the year you have a manuscript. And I completely dismissed it, because, you know, like, a novel was just too big, too out of my frame of reference for what I could write. But you know how things change from when you have starters to by the time you have desserts. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. So by the time dessert came around, I was all gung-ho. And I said, like, yeah, cool. I'm going to write a novel. It's going to happen. It's going to be amazing. Mm-hmm. And then she said, yeah, but it starts tomorrow, this program. And, of course, by the next day, in the cold light of day, I'd already signed up. And she said, well, now you need to have a framework for your novel. And it pretty much happened like that, because the program had deadlines, and I'm quite, maybe it's a legal background, but, you know, it's deadlines. And also, I'd given my word, I'd committed to it. Mm-hmm. And that completely switched it from just being something that I was doing for fun, but into something that I'd committed to doing. I'd told somebody, whereas before it had all been in my head, you know. And that worked. And by the end of the year, I had a manuscript. And the idea for being Kari came from advice that Claire had given me initially. When I said, oh, I don't have a story, I haven't got something that I've always wanted to write. And she said to me, well, write what you're interested in, because it's got to be something that sustains you over all the time that you write. And what, I guess maybe it's a time of life that I'm in, but what caught me is the support that women friends give each other. So, you know, I had this idea that I wanted to write a story of tight women friends and something that came out of that. And I had this idea I was going to write a Cape Town Sex in the City. I was going to be all like sexy and dresses and clothes and the whole thing. And then I couldn't write that much sex, and the dresses sort of fell by the wayside. And so I created this group of friends, which was Kari, Shelley, Lily, and Di. And that's where it started. And because also what does interest me is relationships between people, between parents, between in a romantic sense also. And so the story developed from there. Also, Kari's story is, she is married, she is estranged from her Muslim family, she lives in Cape Town, Bloberg Strand, and her crisis comes on Valentine's Day, because she's a big Valentine's Day kind of girl.
She's romantic.
Yes. But her meltdown comes on that day. She finds out that her husband's had a one-night stand and that her grandmother's died. And this apocalypse draws her back into her family that she hasn't seen for 10 years. So the story is about how she tries to reconcile her identity within herself, and then also her relationship. Where Being Lily, which is my newest book, comes in, is that Lily is Kari's best friend, and she is getting married. A first-time 39-year-old doctor, who is cynical about this whole love and marriage thing, never thought she would do it, has now found herself in this whole wedding vibe and going what I call bradzilly, Lily bradzilly. So that's the one part of it, is that why in this day and age do we still get married? What is the impetus for it? Because there really is no need, if you take out the sort of religious need for it. And then also Lily has decided not to have children. And that gets put under some pressure when Owen's ex arrives with a kid that could be his. So it's a story written about love and relationships, about whether you should get married and about children. And it's kind of half serious, half tongue-in-cheek. And I guess that's the gist of it.
Yeah, actually, this is like quite a great segue to go into the conversation, because at least you've summed it up nicely, right? Mm-hmm. So, Amma and I normally, like, we finish books and then we have like our long conversations about, oh my gosh, I'm so frustrated, or oh my god, like, what do you mean, right? And I finished the book and I phone her and I'm like, listen, you need to finish this book because we need to have a conversation.
Okay.
Particularly about the characters, I think that you spend quite a bit of time like molding and creating these characters. Yeah. And obviously now I'm interested to read Being Kerry because I want to see like how the dynamics and the relationships work there in comparison to Being Lily.
Mm.
Right? I mean, the first thing to talk about is what you've already alluded to, right? So you wanted to explore these ideas of marriage and our understandings of marriage, right? And through these various people, because we have Lily, who is about to get married.
Yes.
We've got Di, who is in a situation.
Yes.
We've got Shirley, who seems to be happily married.
Yes.
And then we've got Kerry, who also, it's quite dubious, but it seems it's getting there.
Yeah.
So why was it important for you to sort of speak about these different forms of marriage?
We're taking a short break.
Are you a Caribbean American? Are you looking for a podcast that truly speaks to your culture and identity? Look no further than Carry On Friends, the ultimate destination for all things Caribbean American, hosted by me, Carrie Ann. Dive deep into topics such as culture, heritage, and everyday life through the unique lens of the Caribbean American experience. You'll walk away feeling more connected to your roots. Follow and listen on Apple Podcasts so you'll never miss an episode of Carry On Friends, the Caribbean American experience. Your Caribbean American community awaits.
I think because, especially when I was growing up, which is maybe a bit later than when you were growing up, but you know, there's this idea that when you get married, it's not that you're happy ever after, because you know that's sort of stripped away from you quite quickly. But there's this idea that when you're married, you settle.
Mm.
And not settled as in, you know, you're not getting what you want, so therefore you're settling for that. But that your life is now settled and stable and that things are just fine. But obviously it's not. I mean, you see people get divorced all the time, right? So that's not an issue. But I wanted to show within different relationships, in different stages of it, making it work or not making it work, to sort of lift that wedding veil, in a sense, you know.
The corporate veil.
Yeah. I know, a lawyer sitting right here. So it was kind of that, to just like, you know, just bring a little bit of nuance into what we see all around us all the time. We've all got friends in various stages of happy ever after.
Yeah.
Or not so happy.
Or not so happy.
And I mean, it was interesting because there were a lot of unsuccessful relationships in this book.
Yes.
That just challenge your own ideas of what a happy marriage is, you know? So you have a couple that chooses to reconcile following an episode of infidelity, and you have a couple that chooses not to. And I was wondering, you know, if the one couple's more successful than the other, or they just living out their truths, you know?
Yeah, but also, like, when I think about the engagement between Alan and Anne, and how, you know, he was like, you're the love of my life. I was like, how dare, what?
Yeah. Like, also, the like weird compromises that women make in order to appear to be graceful and nice, you know? So, I don't know if I would have been so nice to have gone to this, like, engagement party where Alan is going to be with this woman and he's... I felt like, you know, it speaks to this idea that women are always wanting to be graceful and we're always wanting to be nice, even to our own detriments. You know, she could have gone without hearing him speak about how this woman is the love of his life.
Yeah.
I've never been this happy in
my
life.
She's my soulmate.
I think the big difference is that Di's got children.
Mm.
And I think for parents, whether you're a mother or father, I think children do once a relationship has fallen down, people do still do things that they wouldn't otherwise do because of those kids. Mm. And I is motivated by keeping this, we are all nice and we're all getting on.
Sort of a happy family.
Because exactly, it is the whole playing happy family story. And I wanted to lift that out also because, you know, we all see what we see. Mm. But sometimes to look a little bit behind what is happening there, maybe it isn't what you see.
Mm. I mean, in speaking about relationships, for me, it's important because I think the men in this book are trash.
Oh.
Rage, they are so trash, right? So we've got this encounter of Alan and Alan being problematic because I think Alan could have handled it differently. Mm. I really think that Alan didn't take into account Dai's feelings when he said that. Mm. And also, it's this idea that sometimes men just shoot from the hip, right?
Yeah. I'm a bit sad because, in a sense, you know, I really didn't write them to be trash. I don't feel trashy about them. I've got quite soft feelings for them. And with Alan in particular, you know, I almost wanted to write him. He is madly in love.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's always a cynicism that comes sometimes with second marriages, third marriages, whatever far down the line you are.
Mm.
And I wanted him to be caught up in this second chance.
Mm.
And because it does happen like that, not maybe to all men, but to some men. But the stereotype is often that it's women that get caught up in this love and the whole fantasy that it's all going to be fantastic. And I wanted to have a man that was maybe a little bit in touch with his feelings. And why can't it be a divorced guy that goes there?
See, I suppose the other difficulty is that we know this narrative, like, just in society, right? That women are always extending grace to certain people, right?
Yeah.
And then men act in unbecoming ways, right? So for me, I did not necessarily have an issue with the caught up in love bit. But I think that the manifestation of the caught up in love was trashy.
Yeah.
So he could have
how he still comes over.
Like, the coffee situation, you know, for me,
because
I was like...
It's like, he knows...
I agree with you, though. I
he knows that Dai has this, like, that she has a soft spot for him, you know, and that she's trying to not appear to be bitter, and she wants to be the good person, because she also is the one who couldn't move on from the infidelity, right? So she's already carrying that burden that I couldn't move on from this infidelity. Now she can't also be catty and be petty and be all these things. She might really want to be on the inside.
Yeah.
And then he still wants to come over for, like, you know, it's just, I felt like this man wants to have his, like, bread buttered on both sides, you know, so he can move on and have this woman that he's in love with, who's his soulmate, but you're still taking up Dai's time and like, asking her to do this emotional labor because you come over while she gets ready. I read that, and, you know, when her friends were shocked, I was like, I am in full agreement with Shelley's face. I'm like, this doesn't make sense.
But I love that you say that, though, because I agree with the sentiment.
Mm-hmm.
And part of why I have these group of friends is to lift that out, is to say, hey, what's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
So that, because that, I think, is the strength of friendships.
Mm-hmm.
So that we all do things when you're in a particular moment because you're caught up by whatever feelings it might be. That's not objectively, you know, the right thing to do in that moment. But you do it, whether it's in your career or in your relationships or with your children. But for as long as you've got, or hopefully you've got that friend that lifts it out and says, hey, listen, maybe that's like a ridiculous thing to do. And, you know, so I agree with what you're saying, but in a sense it's almost, I wanted it to be like that because it does reflect reality. But I wanted her to have the benefit of somebody calling her out on it.
Yeah,
I find the female friendships particularly interesting in this book. I think often people want to have the facade of the happy marriage and the great lives. These women really don't. They're very honest with each other. Like, I think honest even down to their sex lives. You know? They're very honest with each other, even with their difficulties. And I found that to be very interesting. That, you know, especially in very, like, insular communities that are quite privileged and that feel the pressure to maintain the facade of perfection. Here's this group of women that are just, like, letting rip. I mean, she tells her friends, Lily tells her friends on WhatsApp about Owen and all his shenanigans. She doesn't hold back.
Yeah.
And I'm curious as to why you chose to have so much honesty in this group of friends.
Well, I think maybe it is the optimistic side of me. Mm-hmm. But I have found a lot of value in my own friendships, mm-hmm. and I've found them to be deeper as I've gone older. Mm-hmm. So the quality of the friendships that I've got at this point in my life is completely different to when I was at varsity or just sort of high school kind of thing. Then there was a lot more guardedness. Mm-hmm. But I found that as I've got older, the women that I've got to know have all realized, in a sense, that nobody's life's perfect. Mm-hmm. So they don't let it hang out with everyone, but it's a lot more open with certain individuals in a group. Mm. So I think a part of me is optimistic about it. Mm. I hope that is what happens within certain groups of people.
So.
I've experienced some of it, mm-hmm. and I've heard other people talk about it. And I guess also, in a sense, I want to model it. Okay?
It's a really refreshing view of friendship. I think that female friendships get a lot of bad rep. You know, they get a lot of bad rep about how women are just not supportive of each other, we're catty, there's always frenemies.
Yeah.
But with them, they're really, really honest about the ways that they feel about each other, and you get a sense of authenticity in their friendship. So that's why they can call each other out and call each other to be accountable. And there's a lot of accountability as a theme in the book. People are always calling each other out. Yeah.
Always calling each other accountable.
Also, except for Owen.
It's also, I think, group friendships also do go through particular phases.
Mm, mm,
so they might come a time where things are a little bit out because a friendship is just a particular kind of relationship in the way that I see it. And so at this particular time, they see each other a lot. They've got a lot of overlap. So in a sense, it's easy to be quite close and connected. But things might change.
And I mean, in some ways it has been, right? Because with Kerry moving to London, there was quite a bit of a change in the dynamics of friendship. And, you know, what I always was wondering is whether Daya and Shirley were their own coupling and Kerry and Lily were their own coupling.
Yeah.
Because it seems that Lily and Kerry have quite a lot of conversations.
Yeah.
Although they have this WhatsApp group, it just seems like Lily would know more about Kerry than the others may have necessarily.
Yeah.
Because sometimes those are the dynamics of friendships that you talk to certain people about certain things.
Mm.
They are honest with each other, but there are certain things that only Lily will experience that other people will not experience.
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking about the scene where Lily was crying on the FaceTime conversation and how, like, perhaps it would have been a different conversation if it was with Di.
Yeah.
You know?
I think that's very astute because it is how I wrote it. But it's also, I guess, how I've experienced friendships,
mm-hmm.
is that you have got different connections with different friends,
mm-hmm.
And they're not, one is not less valuable than the other, but they fulfill a different aspect of friendship.
Lily has a very unpopular view of, speaking about the evolution of friendships, right?
Mm.
Lily chooses not to have children.
Yes.
And she's in the social circle where everybody has children, and it comes up often, you know, even in their criticism of her, when they don't like something that she does, then they say, but it's because you're not a mother, you don't understand.
Yeah.
Why did you choose to make Lily, who is this, you know, successful woman that has all of these things going for her, why did you particularly choose to make her childless?
It's interesting because it goes back to that whole idea that, you know, characters can just go off and do something without you as a writer.
Mm.
She told her own story,
yeah,
basically.
But it wasn't like that. It's because when I created these characters, it's like when you've got friends, these characters become my friends. And so I can imagine what they would do and what they would say. And what they would shop and wear and all of that.
And it would be uncharacteristic of someone like Lily to want a child.
She was, the way that I built her, she was the kind of person that would say, but it's not important to me.
Mm.
But it's fine if you want to do it, and I'm happy for you, but this is my choice. She is independent, bloody-minded, independent. She does what she wants to do. She knows her own mind. She knows what she wants out of life. She is slightly neurotic, not likable always, quite bossy, but she made decisions for her life and she goes out and seeks to fulfill them. And so it wasn't so much that I chose for her to be like that, but that was right for that character.
Mm.
And the more it came out, the more it was
But I think also what's interesting is even though Lily became this person, it seems that the encounter with this potential child,
yeah.
sort of changes a lot of things, or Lily starts grappling with a lot of her own things, like about why do I really want to be childless, like what does this mean for me and stuff like that. And was that intentional? Was the plot twist effectively for her to question for herself why it is that she made the decision not to have a child?
Yeah, I did. It was intentional because I felt that it echoes how life works, is that we all have very strong views on something. Mm. I mean, you know, when you're 20, you think you know everything, exactly how your life's going to be and what you're going to study and what you're going... And then things happen to you that make you evaluate your choices. And sometimes it validates your initial decision, but other times it makes you change your mind. And I think that is the fantastic thing about being human, though, is that you can change your mind. And so I wanted to give this steadfast character who was convinced that she knew how it was going to be, I wanted to give her a little bit of a shake and say, well, think about it. Do you, is that what you really want?
Speaking of thinking about things, Owen is an interesting character for me. He's very interesting.
I mean, am you using the word interesting?
Or are you going to say special?
Owen is a problematic fave for a lot of reasons.
Okay.
I think that he has his own personal insecurities. Mm. I mean, him and Lily come from very diverse backgrounds, right? And he has his own...
She comes from a privileged background. Yes. Him not so much.
Yeah. Him not so much, but... He's also not extremely disadvantaged,
true.
And he's been able to move up in the world.
Yeah. And it seems in some ways that Owen is white passing.
Yeah, it seems
it
like...
It seems like, you know, when you meet people and you're like, I wondered what her...
Yeah.
The orig, the ethnicity is.
Because they say he looks like he's Italian or something Mediterranean. Yeah. So he is passing, right? But for me, like I...
Interesting,
I have a problem with the way in which Owen, I feel like sometimes doesn't want to take... full responsibility for certain things. Mm. So Lily is very clear about certain things, right?
Yeah.
Lily doesn't want to have children.
Yeah.
She's chosen to live her life this way. She's very clear, and I think she walks into this relationship with this transparency, and this is who she is. She's 39. She doesn't have time to convince you whether you're going to come on board or not.
Yeah.
Owen is flip-floppy about a lot of things. You know, he... sort of... He does want children, but he wouldn't mind, you know? He... doesn't mind having a big wedding, but he would be okay with this morning. I feel like he really removes himself from making a lot of the big decisions.
Yeah.
And it makes him really unlikable to me, particularly when Courtney enters the picture. I think that that whole situation would not have happened in my house. Like, to start off with, that whole situation. And I'm shocked that Lily allowed it to happen, knowing the kind of character that she was, right?
But I think, for me, right, I think it's two things. I think on the one hand, I think that Owen is really trashy. Like, honestly, Owen just needs to go somewhere else. Because I think that Owen is too much of a nice guy, right? But I also
think
yeah, but I think Owen is also has unresolved feelings for Courtney.
Mm.
And this is his way, because you know he constantly refers to this idea of like, we didn't end things nicely, and you know, this is the least that I can do. I'm like, you don't owe anyone anything for the end of a relationship. And I think he's trying to he is trying to make up for the bad, right? On the one hand. But I think on the other hand, Owen is also like, was swept by Lily. And sort of, when he was swept by Lily, it sort of is like, you know, when you're in a relationship and one person is like domineering in the decision making, and for peace and compromise in the relationship, you say yes, even though you don't agree with that. And I felt that Courtney was the person to bring out these little nuances that Owen's actually not that cut up about.
But my thing is also the way in which Owen chooses to assert himself is problematic to me. So it's fine to say that you feel some type of way. And I also have a problem with this narrative of like, this woman came and she swept me and I just didn't have any choice. He had a lot of agency because Lily, if you read the book, Lily is very like, very cognizant of the fact that people find her domineering. I think that when you are a woman who is very opinionated and who's very strong, you cannot go through this world without knowing that people find you bossy and irritating and unlikable.
Yeah.
So Lily is very cognizant of that, and she behaves in ways that are like, you can see she's constantly censoring herself.
Yeah.
She's like, I don't want to step on Owen's toes.
Yeah.
Will he be okay with this? So it's problematic to me that he waits for his ex-girlfriend to come into the picture to assert himself, right? Because he always wants to be like, almost like the victim. Like, you know, she chose chose the honeymoon location. Yeah. She chose to have this big wedding. Like, at which point was he going to assert himself?
Well, so. You see, I wanted Owen to be the contrast to Lily. Mm. And I wanted to challenge the stereotypes. Mm. Because if Lily was the man in the setup, it would be, I think, more acceptable for an in-charge bossy. Mm. I'm taking control. I want to go here on honeymoon. I've got money to spend. I'm the doctor. You know. Mm. And I wanted to turn that on its head. I wanted to say, why do we judge a woman more harshly for being like that?
Mm.
And the foil for that is Owen, who is fluid in everything.
Mm.
He's fluid in his identity, in a sense, in that he's got this mixed heritage, but he's not really attached to either. He's just sort of floated. He hasn't made a definite decision about anything. Life has
He's
just
sort of like Cape Tonian, you know. Like,
he's from Durban.
Also coastal, like very coastal, like really relaxed.
Yeah, so I wanted to have the contrast of this really chilled personality who has, in essence, allowed things to happen to him.
Mm.
He's been swept away by things.
Mm-hmm.
And contrast this with a very sharp personality of Lily, who has chosen things.
Mm.
She's chosen a career. She's chosen to make a career change. She's chosen not to have children. And so here are these two personalities that come together that work exactly because they have these two personalities. And I wanted, in the same way that I wanted to challenge Lily's steadfastness in an idea, I wanted to challenge Owen's almost jelly spine. And you know, when you're not accustomed to asserting yourself, I don't think it comes out necessarily in the way that it's intended. Or, you know, it comes out awkwardly, in the same way as somebody that's maybe used to being offensive in a way, tries to be nice, it comes on, it's quite like forced. So I wanted that contrast for Owen and Lily, because I really wanted to challenge their sort of gender presentation. So there was, so you know, he doesn't deal with it well.
He doesn't deal with anything well.
At
it seems
all,
like
at all.
I just, for me, I really was angry at Owen most of the time.
Okay.
Because I felt that Owen, this jelly spine, it really is actually the perfect description for Owen. Because I felt that, okay, so he's like, you know, Lily, these people don't have da-da-da. They stay much longer than they should have stayed in that house, right? And Owen doesn't even address Courtney to be like, hey, Court.
Well, the thing, what I really wanted to do there also was, I wanted to highlight how people change when they have the possibility of a child or they have a child. Mm. And it's not a sensible, logical thing. Because he would, you know, in normal circumstances, I don't know what normal is, but you know, if somebody just arrives out of nowhere with a bag and says, I don't have a place to stay, and please can I stay with you, you'd go like, maybe a night, if you really like them. But when you're confronted with the possibility that this could be your child, it switches something.
Mm.
And I think Owen doesn't know what to do with it.
Mm.
I also think, for me, it brought into the fore Owen's personal childhood thing that he hadn't really dealt with. So, I mean, Owen's father had, he's this child, he's the result of a mixed relationship at a time in which it was illegal.
Yeah.
So he gets raised by a white mother, but his father is not white.
Yeah.
And he knows it as well because he's not quite white. He's white passing, but he's not quite white, you know. And I don't think that Owen had ever really dealt with his own feelings of abandonment.
Yeah.
And that's why he felt that he couldn't possibly take a stand in relating with Courtney and Kiara, because it would be like re-abandoning, you know, it would be that abandonment again. And I think, for me, that's what came out.
Yes, I agree. That was part of what I intended, is that I wanted him to also face his lack of his lack of parenting, his lack of having a strong father, and the realization that I can be better, I can do better, even though I hadn't thought, this whole child thing hadn't entered my frame of reference until now. Here comes the opportunity, so I've got to do something with it.
But it also seems that Owen, in the back of his mind, had a possibility that something like this could happen.
Okay.
Because when Courtney and Kiara show up, like, it's not like a, I mean, he's surprised to see them in Cape Town, obviously, but I felt that the accepting of the possibility of a child was very easy.
Yeah.
Like, very easy, like, yeah, it seems like, it just felt like, for me, part of the discomfort and the wanting to help is that he knows he screwed up and may have screwed up to this extent.
Yeah, and I mean, which of us? What is that? Is it who of us? Come on, somebody help me. But when you have some kind of issue from your past, and you know you could have stuffed up, there is, I think, a natural tendency to overcompensate.
Yeah, and he did a lot of overcompensation.
So, I mean, when you have a little bit of guilt about when you were young and you really were not as clever or as emotionally astute as you should have been, and now you are faced with that person, you think, okay.
I think that Owen didn't really show up for Kiara in the ways that he needed to when it counted. And it allowed Courtney to behave the way that she did. Because Courtney is problematic AF. Like, Courtney would not have stayed a week in the house. Yeah. Like,
one night, no bags, nothing.
I would have been like, babe, I know a good Airbnb.
Yeah.
Like,
well, I mean, also, Lily was willing. This is Owen. Yeah. This is Owen's dodginess. Because Lily was like, they can stay in a hotel. Like, I can pay for them, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
but he still wants to be like, but like, selectively macho. Like, no, I want to make this decision. And then Courtney behaves in such problematic ways. And you can tell in how she relates to Owen, right? Mm. Like, she's very flirtatious in front of her parents. Mm. I mean, And Owen still then wants to just sweep. It's this thing that Owen does that he never wants to confront things.
Yeah.
So he still wants to sweep it under the carpet. And for me, the scene, you know, where Courtney just is ultimately disrespectful to Lily, that would have been tickets for everybody. Because Owen had an opportunity to step in and say something, right? And Owen was like, you know, like, he's been using his voice and being this macho, you know, assertive man this whole time, and he's forcing Lily to accept these people just living in her house with no alternative plan. Lily starts collecting this child from school. And Owen, for me, should have stepped in. He knows Lily's character. And he had an opportunity to step in and say something when Courtney was running her mouth in Lily's house.
And then he kicking, didn't. Kicking. Ooh, wait, King.
But Lily.
I would have let her go. Like, Courtney.
You would have let her go long.
Courtney. Ooh, no.
But it speaks to that. To that, like, that lack of this spine that Owen had, right? Mm. How do you let somebody come into your house?
Mm.
And I don't believe that Lily did anything wrong. I mean, I just feel that if a child, there's a whole scene, we don't want to give away too much, but there's a scene where Lily has to really behave as like proxy parent, doctor, and Lily doesn't have any children. She's being thrown in the deep end, and she makes the decision that she feels is most appropriate for the child. Right?
And I think also it speaks to how...
And Owen didn't give her the benefit of the doubt. He had an opportunity to step in and say, this is who I know Lily to be, and it has nothing to do with her being rich or her wanting to assert herself. This is just who I know her to be. And
it is also in the same way that it's a process for Lily to get to a point where she understands. For example, what I wanted her to understand is that money doesn't solve all of her problems.
Yeah, and I mean, you portrayed that quite well.
So Lily, I wanted Lily to go through a process where she understands that it's not all about what she decides and what she can buy and in a relationship, not just what she determines. I also wanted Owen to go through a process where he understands that he has to take a stand.
Mm.
And he gets there eventually. He doesn't get there in the way that Lily wants him to.
Or as like just a whatever normal may look like a normal person who reacted. But I think also
it was a different process to get him there.
Yeah.
And I think we have an expectation of what assertiveness looks like.
Yeah, that's true. That's
and
true.
And also what assertiveness looks like in a man.
Mm.
And I wanted him to be a little bit different because that is also the attraction that Lily has to him is that he's not like her father. He's not like any of the other men that she knows. He is the guy who was the only guy in a group of women friends, but not a gay guy, which is also the stereotype that also comes a group of friends. You've got a gay man who is part of it. So he is different. And I wanted him to get there in a different way.
But I also
think... The scenic coastal route. He gets there.
Yeah.
I think also, for me... This particular scene, right, really also shows another side of Lily. Because Lily could have thrown money at the problem, but I think hanging out with Chiara really does something for Lily in the way that Courtney can't, and in a way that Owen can't, right? So she's also looking or searching through her maternal instincts, right? And being like, okay, let's try and see what's best for the child, right? Because, like, I mean, I think that Lily would have acted differently to the other scene, you know, where she is in her house and she sees what's happening. She would have acted differently being who she was.
Yeah.
She would have been like, pack your bags, get out of my house, you know. But she wasn't like that. Yeah, she wasn't like that. She was just basically like, okay, shit, I don't know what people are supposed to do in this situation, but I also want to honor the person who is part of the situation. Yeah. Right, so it for me, it also showed a different side of Lily in the way that we know
And
Lily.
A growth, right? Because Lily is so used to being in control. Things Lily has a plan. Like, Lily has a plan A, B, C, and D. And she learns, right? Because I think the people in her life sort of acquiesce her. You know, they... Lily's
and I understand. With friends, you know, you understand one is the organizer, one goes along with everything else, one maybe just drinks too much.
So, and she's a little bit spoiled as well, right? Yeah. Because the way that Lily speaks to her parents, sometimes I'm just like, you.
Yeah.
You said what to your mother?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
And I think that the people in her life really acquiesce her, sometimes to her detriment, because Lily can be very... not understanding of other people's emotions and feelings, because if Lily feels that this is the way that something should be, this is the way that it should be, and she's forced to grow, because you can't do that with a teenager. Like, you can do that with adults, because adults sort of understand, oh, this is your personality, this is what I will benefit from behaving in a certain way towards you. Teenagers don't feel that way. Chiara doesn't really care about
because I wanted to have Lily have this experience, because in the first book of Being Carrie, Lily is a little bit, she's Carrie's best friend, but she is also a little bit of a know-it-all. You might, should have done that.
She's definitely still a know-it-all.
You should have done that. You should, you know. And so she's always the one, I guess, that Carrie measures herself to, because she would know what the right thing to do is. So I wanted to take this personality that's in such sharp contrast to Carrie. So somebody that has got a plan, but not just got a plan, he's one of those rare individuals who have the next step to make the plan happen. She's one of those. And so I wanted her to have the challenges of these people around her to say that, well, you're not always right, and there are different ways to deal with it. And to sort of challenge her very steadfast views on marriage.
But
and
I also...
She has steadfast views on everything. Like, I think all her views are... initially set in stone. It takes a lot for...
And she's not... I mean, she's not initially a very likable character. She's not somebody that you would meet and want to be friends with. I mean, she is incredibly privileged. She's from a wealthy family. She's good to look at. She's got a... Now she's getting engaged. She's got the whole package. But I also wanted to challenge that, because what you see isn't always what you get.
I know you like reading about unlikable characters.
Especially unlikable women. Because sometimes a lot of our reasons for disliking women are rooted in these very strange standards that we hold women to.
Yes.
So I like the fact that she was unlikable. It made me wonder why I didn't like Lily. Because if it had been the other way around, would I have disliked Owen if he had Lily's personality?
And I also like the fact that Lily knew she was unlikable. She was like, you know, I know people don't warm up to me easily. I know this about myself. Taking ownership of, like, and not being... she was very unapologetic about it. It wasn't like, oh, I apologize.
She still got sad, and I liked that, because that was human. You know, she has her moments of weakness where she talks, she's with someone, she's like, yeah, people don't really like me. And I thought that was very true. Even as secure and as steadfast as whatever you are, I think it's a very human need to want people to sort of approve of you and to like you, and to not always feel like you have to prove that you're a good person before people warm up to you.
And
this is the contrast also with Owen, is that he is completely the opposite. He wants everybody to like him. He's that kid. That everybody likes, that the kids all
that's
like.
Why Courtney...
And so this, for me, was also the attraction between the two. Because I think in friendships and sometimes in relationships, you are attracted to what you don't have within yourself. And so they would be extremely different. I mean, he sees her confidence. She sees his, what she says as easygoingness, not so much James Bond.
Interesting that the things that you can like or be attracted to in a person can also then... become the things that you intensely dislike or that drive you apart from that person, because
This is exactly what happens with them also.
Yeah, that exactly happens, that she's initially attracted to him being easygoing when it benefits her, right? So when he lets her make all the decisions and she gets to boss him around, she loves it. When it's not working in her favor, then she's...
When somebody else is making the decisions, not so much
fun. But I think also what I really liked about Lily, knowing that she's unlikable, was where Carrie comes in, right? Mm. So she knew that she is... She's the, I know how to deal with this. And literally she even has conversations. She's like, I'm going to say something, you're going to say something, this is going to go. But she realizes that people don't function like that. And that's where Carrie comes in, right? To, you know, ever so often she messages Carrie to be like, girl, I know what I'm about to do is not what I'm supposed to do. So like, just speak me out of it or talk me down or something like that. And I really like the fact that she had the emotional intelligence to know that, listen, I know the way that I'm thinking about this is not the way it's going to go down. So let me talk to someone else about that.
Sure, guys. Though, I must say, it hurts me deeply to trash talk Owen.
He's a problematic fave. I don't lie. I struggled to see why Lily would ever land up with somebody like Owen. Like, I was looking, I'm like... Opposites must just really attract. Like, but you can also see the dynamics of why they work. There's they're that unlikely couple in your social circle who love each other dearly and nobody knows
what they're together. Nobody else gets it.
Because her parents don't particularly approve of him, right? And that leads me to the other part. I think the book subtly touches on like race dynamics.
I was about to use exactly those words and be like, you know, it's not a major theme in the book, but it's a...
But you left asking some questions because, I mean, Kari is their only non-like white friend, right? And Kari's married to a white man, so she has some proximity and some access to whiteness and to privilege. These three make some interesting comments, and I'm just like, where are you from? When it's Di who starts dating
Andy.
And then they have that incident. I don't want to give it away, but they have an incident where people's just low-key racism becomes high-key, you know? And
but it reminds me of, like, really white suburbia. Like, that particular scene reminds me of exactly how it would take place in white suburbia.
They're friends with a woman of color, so it's not that they haven't interacted with non-white people before, right? They're with black people, with colored women. Kari, when I was reading this, I thought that she wasn't, right? I thought she was colored or she was Indian, you know? And I'm like, so you've obviously interacted with... people of color, like way, and the...
I think what I wanted to do with it was not to, I mean, you used the word subtle, and in a sense that's true, but it's also for me a constant in that these women are in their friendship bubble. They live mostly in a gated estate. So it's a very specific kind of community. There is a particular level of privilege. But even within that, it's the race elements live like an extra, like a ghost in a sense. It's there. Almost felt like you don't have to make a big deal of it. But I wanted to include it because it is real. It is how people live within bubble communities.
Because they didn't have a black friend in their social circle. They're in South Africa. They're in the Western Cape. They don't have a black friend. Like, the black person...
Which is not...
untrue.
It's not untrue. Which is not untrue. And I almost felt that... should there be a token black friend when it didn't start off as a series like that? Because what my intention initially was not to build a series. So when I started being Caddy and I had this woman with these friends, my intention was very much to show her straddling these two worlds that she was in. And so that was the dynamic of it. And then when I was done with it, I still loved these women. And so then came being Lily. So it was as much of a surprise to me as anyone else.
It's like, oh, crap, they are still here.
You know, so it was, for me, I guess partly what I've experienced as a Cape Townian is that people do live in bubbles. And, you know, people do go, well, how many black friends do you have? How many people of color do you know that you're not working with? It's a very real, very awkward question. But it is there. And I wanted to bring it out in my book. Not to just ignored it, but it's a real thing.
I thought for me what was really interesting about the subtlety, not so subtle conversation, was thinking about, like, and this is a conversation that I was having with my friend. I'm like, you know, I'm reading this book, right? And obviously it's about, like, white suburban women, because only they can go on the way that these women are going on.
It's harsh.
But what was a really interesting conversation for me was about who owns our stories, right? Mm. And what I wanted just to have a conversation about was the idea that you could authentically write a story about being Lily, right? Mm. Because we're saturated in a white world.
Yes. Mm.
So, like, these characters are believable. Mm. Like, we know these women. We know them. But a white woman could not have written an authentic story about a black woman in the way that you wrote being Lily.
Yeah.
But even when we read Bin Kerry, in the way that you would have written about Karima.
Yeah.
Right? Mm. And that's interesting. So I suppose my question is, who owns our stories?
The code switching for me, right? Mm-hmm. And the idea that you enter these spaces, and we have some proximity to whiteness and to all that privilege by virtue of where you work, your education, or whatever else you have, in ways that they wouldn't necessarily have extended themselves of us, right? So the idea that I could imagine this. I don't have a circle of friends that are, like, living in Camps Bay.
Yeah.
But I know these women.
Yeah.
Like, I wasn't shocked.
Yeah.
I was sitting there, I'm like, oh, yes, I know Adai.
Yeah.
Yes, I know
Shelly.
And maybe it's just that. It's the way in which we, as people of color, have to navigate our lives in ways that white privileged people don't necessarily have to. Like, they don't really, will never ever interact with us in ways that would require them to study and be observant and come into contact with us. I mean, when would they be able to write about a group of four women in Guguletu and it would be believable?
Yeah.
Because they don't have that life experience.
Yeah.
There's nothing in their bubbles and their gated communities that would force these. Whereas you wake up every day and you interact with that
person. But I wonder, in the essence of it, in the essence of the issues that these women are facing. I mean, I wrote them in a particular way in this bubble community, but I'd like to think that they transcend.
The universal issues.
Yes, so,
yes.
So for me, that's the thing that I think, or that I hope anyone can relate to.
Mm.
Because I think the times are changing. The whole idea about that you must get married, people challenge that.
Mm.
The whole idea that you must have a child.
So I think
So it for me, that is the universality of it.
The themes are very universal.
I think, the themes are very universal.
Yeah.
The story itself is a white story, right? And for me, that was interesting to be like, these women are we know them.
Mm.
In the same way that if he had written about four Cape Townian women growing up in a Mitchell's Plain or a Balval, it would have been the same, right? Because at least there would be a different element, a different cultural element that comes with living in places like Mitchell's Plain and living in Balval.
I think it made it more believable for me, though, that these were very, because we don't often have access to privilege in the sense that you don't know their personal lives, right? Because you're not privy to that. It's a very gated bubble, you know. But the themes were so universal that you could relate to Shelly feeling the way that she did, right? You can relate to Di and that whole strange dynamic. You could, because it's universal. I think that, and that's what made these. I mean, ordinarily it wouldn't be a relatable story, right? Because you don't have that social circle.
Yeah.
But the themes are so universal, like dealing with infidelity, dealing with infertility, dealing with other people's expectations of what you as a woman should be, and the idea that you, as privileged as you are still having to deal with these strange patriarchal notions, right? As high achieving as Lily is, Lily still has to account to other people as to why she. Because people keep saying, oh, you know, you'll come around. You will want to have a child.
But I really did want to write. Well, when I say I did want to write it, for me it felt authentic to write it in a bubble way.
No.
If you understand what
this
I mean.
This is really what we deserve. Like, I think.
But do you understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For me, it felt authentic to have it this way, because this is how these women would operate.
But you know what? What I really enjoyed it is that this is true, right? So the woman who lives in Camps Bay live in a gated community. Mm-hmm. They hang out with women who live in Camps Bay or the women who live in Clifton. Yeah. That is true. Like, yeah. they're not necessarily going to have a friend who lives in Guguletu and they're going to, like...
Well, the Guguletu people have friends.
Yes. No, that's true. Yeah. But I'm just saying,
so it's
like...
It's a different area.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering, does it make it any less of a bubble? Because that is almost the South African phenomenon, is that we have got these bubbles happening, and they get closer and closer to each other, and they don't always burst, but there's just like a little hand that comes through, and this is Owen's father coming from somewhere else.
So I'll see.
And
he challenges
not that. Hanover Park.
Yeah.
Elsie. And he's just like, not even Elsie Rafi, you know, like they would say. Elsie.
Also, I think Owen's dad challenges a lot of their own they're comfortable with Owen because Owen is passing and he's got that possibility, right? So because of proximity, he's got a possibility. So even if you ask, like, you know, he's okay, he can fit in, he's fine. His father has a completely different lived experience to everybody else, right? So here are these fancy schmancy Clifton people in their Porsches.
Yeah.
He has this beat up, banged car that has just been through the most.
Yeah.
And he's so unapologetic in ways that I don't think Owen has come to yet. You know, his dad owns it. So when these people are shocked that, you know, he lives in a back room and they're like, you can almost hear them just be like, huh? Did you sign the prenup? Owen's dad owns it. You know, Ricardo walks in and he's like, this is me. And for me, that's powerful because it takes a lot to walk into a space like that and not feel that you have to in some way assimilate, right? And I think that's something that Owen is grappling with, you know, because... Owen is like, you know, I'm mixed race, but, you know, I've been able to pass for a lot of my life. And Owen has a lot of deep-held insecurities. That's why he always feels like her parents are disapproving. They think very little of him. He's paranoid about
which
the fact
that... Which they do.
I didn't think, you know, I mean, we've talked now a lot about Owen passing, but I didn't initially think of Owen as being anything but who he was. So, in his mind, he's just Owen. He's not passing as anything. He's just the way that he grew up. That's what he knows. That's what he is. And it's part of, in a way, the South African identity is that he is who he is. But other South Africans, us, we look at him and say, well, this is your heritage. This is where you come from.
This is who you
should
be.
This is who you must be. This is a certain way that you must show up. But in his mind, he's had no connection with a father.
Mm.
He's had a particular upbringing that makes him the son of whoever, the brother of whoever that is who he is. So there's no... there's no conscious passing, if you understand.
No. And I think, the element of passing is not for Owen. It's, for,
it's for
the people who are counting
Owen.
So
this is what I'm saying.
That's what we're saying.
It's the eyes that are on him.
Yes. Because I mean,
that's what I'm saying about palatability. That Owen feels fine. Owen is never in denial of who he is. Like, if you ask him, Owen brings his dad with his beat up car and his stories.
He gives him money and everything.
His dad's just like one of those interesting family characters.
I always think of passing as somebody that puts them out to be something that they're not in order to fit into a particular... And for me, there's a difference there with the expectations that people have of you from where you come from and the comfort zone that you have in yourself. To my mind, Owen is completely comfortable in who he is, jelly spine and all. You know, he shows up, he is who he is. But the South African... nism that we have is that we look at people
and you want to box them
where you've got this, so you must have that, you must show up in this particular way, you must have this particular kind of consciousness,
and you must be embarrassed of, because I mean
I
think that Owen initially struggles, but I think he comes to a place of acceptance with his father, because he has a full like understanding that this is his heritage, this is his father who lives in the Elsie River, and this is whatever, that's who he is, you know?
And here I am,
come to lunch in Camps Bay, you know? And that's, for me, one of the most powerful moments in the book, right? Because they sort of skirt around the issue of his dad, you know, and you can hear that there's an air of disapproval when they speak about his dad, these prim and proper people. And I think that he just gets to a point where he's like, so what must happen? Because I'm related to this person. And
he's not in denial at all about anything.
And I think also for me, like, the conversation about white passing is the privilege that comes with mixedness in this context, right? So Owen also, his passing could be influenced by the fact that he was raised by a white mother, right? So the isms and the mannerisms are somewhat white because that's all he's known, right? He's not necessarily projecting that, but if I was raised by a white woman, for instance, like as black as I am, people, there's a certain thing that would come out of it, right? Even in these privileged middle-class backgrounds that we come from, there's a certain... You definitely are from a certain area.
How they relate to Andy, for example. Yeah. I mean, Andy is... the first, they make an assumption that he's the cop. he's many things.
It's suburbia.
You know, in suburbia, he's many things. And even when they first speak about him, there's a little bit of, like, fetishing. They don't quite know how to place him, right? And I mean, Andy's a successful black man. He comes there looking for property. He doesn't come
there. Also, he's Andy. I'm just saying. It's just like literally suburbia. Yeah, like, you know, Andy.
Andy. And like the way that they relate to him is, even though he in many ways has access to the space, his access is very different, you know? And it almost seems like it's a little bit of an adventure for Di, you know?
Well, I wanted to, with Owen and the contrast with Andy and Diswa.
Andile.
I wanted to contrast that because Owen has been a friend for a very long time.
Yes, he's in the circle.
He's in the circle. Mm. And the same with Carrie. He's in the circle. And so after a while, differences don't get noticed.
Yes.
And so there will be conversations where there's an obliviousness about the other backgrounds, different backgrounds. Mm. But because Andy's new and it's all of a sudden, in your face, so to speak, there's a much more a consciousness of what separates than of what connects.
Yes.
And I guess that's what I wanted to tap into in the way that we live, the way that we experience people, is that the more you see someone, I guess the more you go, well, you're like us. And you forget and you say things that maybe you wouldn't know if you just met them or, you know.
I mean, when they go and visit Carrie's family, I'm just like, what are you doing? When they go and they visit, right, in a way that only people who live in their own bubble can behave, right? So when they're shocked that, you know, that the sister-in-law is there's a second wife and that whole dad, even though all of their husbands have taken part in some sort of relationship with somebody else outside of them, right? They're still so shook. They're like, oh my goodness, what? And it speaks to how in their minds, Carrie is just one of them. Yeah. Like, she doesn't have this diverse background that's different to...
But it's also then when she does, when her family does come in, it's like a bit of a reminder.
Yes, that she is different. Mm. I mean, I really... I don't know. I want to say I enjoyed because I really...
I'm scared to hear what comes next.
No. I really, like, you know, I was talking to Alma and I was saying, like, we always read these, like, heavy books and, you know, like, of, like, the work that black literature still has to do in this country, right? Mm. Is that it has to cover really deep, intense issues, right? And this book written by a woman who is not white... Mm. Which has a happy ending is really important for me, right? Instead of like, oh my God, like Unspoken Truth that we read, which has a happy ending, I'm like, yes, we can have happy endings, right?
But also covers very serious issues in like a, you only realize it later, you know? So when you read that scene and you're shocked and you ask, why am I shocked? Yeah. So it covers, it also then says that you don't always have to cover serious material in ways that make people need to go and like close the book and take a seat and like go meditate post reading, you know. And so it's the idea that there isn't one way to write our stories. And I think often as a country and as a publishing industry, we get so caught up in a specific type of story or a specific type of narrative, right? So it's not authentic if you are a black woman and you don't write about black women having these issues. Then it's not an authentic story.
So what's interesting is James Baldwin speaks about this in one of his interviews, right? He speaks about the idea that why he had to publish Giovanni's Room firstly in the UK before he went to publish it in America was the fact that the publishing industry had created Baldwin as the black voice. Mm. And Baldwin's black voice has a particular market. Mm. And when he was writing Giovanni's Room about Giovanni in Paris, like, and Giovanni not being black, people were like, hold, no, we don't want that, right? Mm-hmm. And he speaks about the idea of creating this monolithic understanding of the black experience and who is the holder of the black experience and authentically telling the black experience. Mm-hmm. How dare black women speak about sex or enjoying themselves or a gated community? Because this is not the issues that black women face.
We must talk about racism, we must talk about misogyny, and it's the danger of just creating this single narrative that doesn't allow people to, I mean, I would have never really thought about the lives of women in Clifton.
Exactly.
I would have just never.
White suburbia.
White suburbia. I would have never really thought about it. I mean, because it just feels like it's a world that's so far removed from me that I never would have thought that, oh, wait, these people might actually have some similar things to, or similar problems to the things that my black girlfriends and I was talking about, you know, and that was really interesting for me, that at the end, Lily, who's this privileged, very spoiled, sometimes unlikable white woman, had me rooting for her at the end. I was just like, yes, go Lily, you know?
I'm very glad to hear you say both of those things, because I do think that there are underlying serious issues, but I wanted to write about them in an accessible way, so that it's relatable no matter who you are, where you come from, what your environment is, even though it does make you go like, oh, this is a bubble community, like what the hell are these people doing with all their portions? But to understand that even within that, there's a common humanity. There are issues that you face as a woman, not all the same issues, but there is this overlap. And I think that sometimes within the society that we live in, it is useful to look at where we overlap. Because there is a lot of focus on where we don't. Mm.
So we really enjoyed reading Bean Lily, because obviously... so for me, my question is what is next for the sequel? Because I felt like in our conversation, there is actually a lot that Owen needs to deal with. Mm. And I would like to sort of know Owen's backstory.
And
that relationship. And even possibly moving forward, what happens after they get married and there is this addition in their lives, right?
Does Lily have a pregnancy scare and so many people?
So what is next for Juanita?
I am working on being Shelley.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I'm working on her because of all of the women, she's the most difficult in the sense that she seems the most frivolous, the most fluffy. All she does is shop and buy Louis Vuitton bags. And I wanted to challenge that. I wanted to challenge that stereotype of this woman that's got nothing to do and nothing in her head besides what she's going to buy next.
I mean, she's interesting because, you know, she married a Jewish man.
Yeah.
And it just seems like there's somewhat of a rebellious spirit to her.
And what I also want, because she is married to a Jewish man, I also wanted to show that the straddling can happen within that gated community.
Mm.
It doesn't have to be as extreme as sort of black and white, Muslim and Afrikaans.
Yeah.
It can be much closer than that. And also, because then also to understand with empathy, how that happens within our various bubbles that we live in. Mm.
So we're waiting for Bean Shelley.
Yes, hopefully.
Is Di going to have a story?
Di will have a story, but Di needs a little bit of time.
I feel like Di should end up marrying a black man.
That she doesn't fetish.
Well, yes.
Or a black woman.
Oh, Di! I remember. Yes, or a black woman.
So, you know, I think, but I do feel like Di needs a bit of time.
Yeah, Dad needs a bit of...
And Owen, are we ever going to get a Being Owen?
No.
No, this is a women's story.
Because I really, for me, I feel that there is a lot of complexity around Owen.
I'm glad that you say that because, you know, the protagonists in these books are women.
Yeah.
Maybe strong women.
Yeah.
And so the men do contrast with him. But it doesn't mean to say that they are less complex creatures.
Mm. Yeah. And I mean, for me, Owen is a complex creature who does crappy things. But is a complex creature who I would really like to know. Because I feel something happened in Owen's past.
Yeah.
And many things have happened in his own past to construct him to be the person that he is. And how we get to this Owen.
I think Owen is a very interesting personality, very interesting character for me also because he is mixed race and he doesn't have a clear identity.
Yeah.
And in South Africa, there's almost a demand to have a clear identity.
Yeah.
You know, wherever you fit in, where do you fit in? you know, yeah. that it's harder to almost accept somebody that is mixed. Sort of vacillates.
Yeah. Yeah. That is true, yeah.
You know, so for me, he's quite interesting of the almost next generation, newer generation of South Africans that don't necessarily identify themselves that closely.
And Kiara, I'm really curious about... Kiara is a troubled child.
Yes.
Like, she really is a troubled child. She vibes a lot.
Yeah.
And the vibing is not always...
Oh, this is when we need a camera. Yeah.
Not always to her benefit. You know, I think that she behaves in... Yes, there is that teenage element of, like, feeling that you're invincible and you're immortal. But there's also ways that she behaves that are very self-destructive outside of her just being a teenager. And... I wonder, will Owen's presence, you know, because she's had her father, like, she, it's not that she grew up in a fatherless home, she's had a father, you know? And, I mean, contrary to all the stories that we hear about all these girls who turn out interesting, and I use that word very loosely, because they don't have fathers. I mean, that's often the criticism that gets labeled at women who do things you don't like. It's always, you've got daddy issues, it's because you didn't have a father. She has a present father, you know? And she's just still a very troubled child, and I don't know if her parents are cognizant of, I don't think that Courtney sees it. I don't think that Courtney sees it, and I don't think that even Owen sees, you know, even when she's having all these, she has a lot of crises for a 16-year-old.
Yeah. I think Kiara, for me, was such an interesting teenager, because I think that when you're an adult and you look at a teenager, you almost want to dismiss everything as teenage angst and, you know, you'll get over it, and it's not like a real thing. But I think the more and more you read that teenagers and that particular time of life is one that is hugely anxiety driven. I mean, you read the rate of teen suicides are higher than any other in South Africa, I think. And so for me, she was a really interesting character. And you know, you can't blame everything on your parents.
But we should have a conversation about Courtney. But I mean, we've had so much conversations already.
Courtney missed four. That's really Courtney is problematic, like, in a lot of ways. In a lot of ways, in the sense that Courtney is one of those people who knows how to weaponize her femininity, right? So Courtney knows how to weaponize this idea that she's fragile, she's vulnerable. She's very good at weaponizing.
And the world has just done her in, right? For Courtney is just like, I have no part in anything that has
There's
happened
no agency. I mean, who wakes up one day and packs their child? Like, this is why Kiara is a mess. Like, she gets packed up. There's no forethought or foresight. And Courtney's the adult in the situation. She's meant to be the caregiver. And she completely absolves herself of that in that moment. But when she's unhappy about something that Lily does, then
she
suddenly...
just, this is my child. Yeah. This is my... You don't have children. This is my child.
When you were leaving your child stranded and you didn't have a place to live, you weren't taking...
You sound suspiciously like Lily. I'm just saying.
I was a very big fan. Lily went through too much.
I'm just saying, doctor.
It just
not
seems
approving, not approving on Courtney.
No, do you know, I felt very sorry for Courtney initially, because I was like, it must take a lot. Initially, I was like, it must take a lot for you to just leave, up and leave, and just land in this place with strangers. But then the way she goes on to behave.
No, but is this not our condition, though? Is that we judge other people's behaviors by our own standards? So you go sort of, what would I do in that situation?
So not even. No. So it's not. It's not even. Okay. No, it's, for me, it's not that, because. Okay. It was, for me, the way that she could be very manipulative, that was really concerning to me. So the idea that she's in a difficult space, it makes sense, right? And the idea that she reached out for help, I could completely understand, because we often make people feel bad for reaching out. We often judge people like, how dare you get help? You must just be so pathetic. And I didn't believe that. But what I did just find concerning was how manipulative she could be. She knew how to play everybody really well. So... you, like, really feel sorry for Courtney, but Courtney's the same person who'll turn around and, like, insult you or flirt with your partner in front of your parents or say... Or, like, then Jeff comes into the picture. Like, she meets Jeff on a plane. How much?
Courtney, Courtney is a lot. So
she's a lot, and not even because I liked Lily. Like, she's just because I didn't really particularly like Lily in the beginning, but just because I think that Courtney knew how to weaponize this idea of vulnerability, right? So even when she's being called to account, like, okay, are you going to get a job? What's the plan? And then, you know, suddenly it's the tears and it's the, how could you do this to me? How can you don't, you know what I've been through? So now I'm like, you've been hard done, but like, would, I just struggled with Courtney.
Which is kind of the intention.
Yeah.
So I'm glad to hear.
Courtney put me through a lot, right? And I also had to
I released her. At some point, I was just like, you know what? I'm not invested in you. Like, I don't care what happens to you.
No, I had to check. Courtney is the character that I think out of everybody forced me to check myself and my privilege the most.
Okay.
Because I was like, oh, this is strange. Why would anybody do this? This sounds like such a funny thing to do. But then I was like, oh, you're speaking from a position of certain privilege, right? You're unlikely to ever find yourself in that kind of position. So
until you do.
Yeah, no.
no, coastal behavior.
No, I'll pass. German is strong.
It's like,
none of that coastal waving.
You be like, because women do that often. You just like, you're like, why would you do that? What is wrong with this woman? And it's not our, we're not conditioned to be able to empathize with other women easily.
Mm.
Particularly women whose behavior we don't approve of.
Mm.
We're not conditioned to empathize with those women easily. So a lot of the time when I felt like I wanted to judge Courtney, I was like, check yourself. and maybe that was the purpose, right? That you write this woman who is so complex and has so much going on for her.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted Courtney to be a challenging woman so that you couldn't dismiss her on the exterior. Because
she's beautiful. She's a beautiful. Mermaid.
She's a mermaid. And I
let her go out.
I didn't want her to be that easily dismissed. I wanted her also to be, in her own way, a very powerful woman.
Mm.
Because
she makes things happen.
She does make things happen.
Yeah. She gets Lily to stay with her for months.
Rent free,
like obligation free. Lily
she
fetching
cooked,
her child.
She cooked. She was a chef. Please.
She did cook.
She cooked wonderful.
About the cooking, though, as well.
Maybe she was cooking up something else. You know,
exactly. She was just like the way to a man's
really,
stomach.
Yeah. I enjoyed the reckoning that I had to do with Courtney as a character. Because you kind of had to like Di and you had to like Kiara. Because she's nice.
Yeah.
You know, they're nice. Kiara's a nice child.
Yeah.
You know, Owen is a problematic fave.
Yeah.
But Lily and Courtney, you need to do the work to.
I wanted to have. For Lily to have a strong opponent, even though I guess Courtney's not really an opponent. She is Lily's imaginary opponent.
Yeah.
A lot of what Lily projects that Courtney's doing may or may not be happening.
Mm.
May or may not be happening.
It's also true. And
What I was trying to say is that Lily gave some of her power away.
That's true. That's true.
Lily also, I think, operates it from a lot of privilege, right?
Yeah.
Because she felt that in many ways she was in a superior position to Courtney, right? Because, I mean, they were living in her house. Lily was the doctor. Lily had all of these things going for her. And, I mean, even when she makes the comments about Courtney's mothering, I'm just like, don't do it, you know? But Lily also operated from I think that Lily always felt that in many ways she was superior to Courtney. And then her paranoia arose from that because how does someone that you feel you're superior to come in and completely destroy?
But I mean, Lily is also a complex woman in that she has got all this privilege, but she's also quite insecure
So Courtney, I think, came to bring out a lot of insecurity in Lily, like in that, okay, so I'm not necessarily domesticated.
Yeah. I'm not the skinniest.
I'm not as likable.
You know, like
people don't.
Yeah. So I also enjoyed that bit.
I mean, Lily has also got her own family stuff.
Yeah.
She's got her own dynamics with her parents. And so what I wanted to bring out was, you know, you see people and you make a view on their privilege.
Yeah,
but,
you make assumptions.
But ultimately, even though we do live in these bubble communities and we are so different, there are things that you can relate to. I mean, we all can relate to a crazy family or to, you know, that
speaking
kind of thing.
Speaking of family dynamics, I think it would be remiss if we didn't cover this. You know, Lily has a very interesting relationship with her family. Her father, in many ways, she holds her father in high regards. I mean, she holds him to a standard that is very loose for everybody else, right? So her father, you know, there's a history of infidelity. He doesn't treat the mom well. And all the other men who do things like that, she's very judgmental of, you know. She's very like, oh, how could you let your husband do this? But her father gets to be made the exception for. And I find that to be a very human trait, that the people we love dearly, we make a lot of exceptions for. And then her half-siblings, she's like weird about them, which is not unbelievable. I think that blended families are difficult, and I don't think that we're a society that has open conversations about blended families. So I feel like her father was like, well, they're here now, so you're going to hang out with them or not. And I mean, when she gets moved by Charlotte's making that comment about how her sister's so smart and her sister's a doctor, I was shocked. I was like, I didn't think Lily would care. You know, Lily often projects this aura of just not being moved by things. And it's like the smallest, simplest things that humanize Lily. I mean, that moment for me made Lily more of a person to me, right? Because I was like, Lily, even you?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's part of, you know, if I go back to the thing that initially interested me about the book, is that I wanted to write a book about how things are changing in the times that we live in, not just about when you get married or when you have children, but what do families look like? What is the family construct now? Because all of the women, all of the families in this book are all different. And none of them look like the kind of families that maybe we imagined ourselves having when we were children, or, you know, the kind of families that our parents would have wanted for us. But this is what we have, this is what we're dealing with, and how we sort of make peace with it. And also the exceptions that you do make for the people that you love and the things that catch you. So it was important for me to lift out that the families were all different.
Very different.
Yeah, so at the Cheeky Natives, we are an interesting bunch because, you know, some people are like, oh, we'll give you more books or we give you popcorn, da-da-da-da. I mean, some of our authors are really astounded when we do this in front of them. So we're like, so how we rate books is we give people land. Because we at the Cheeky Natives are the land committee. So we deliberate. And we're like, okay, which land does this
deserve? I really didn't like what Courtney did, you know. Yeah, so therefore, I had to take off an exam.
Yeah, okay. You know, so that this is how we
I'm glad then it's not televised. You can see my face straight away. I'll pull myself together.
So, I mean, it's white suburbia that you speak about predominantly in the book, right?
Some really wonderful areas.
Rich areas.
That you think you could do some amazing writing in. So at the Cheeky Natives, you've decided to give you a portion of camp space.
Oh, I'll take it.
We hope you'll take it.
Take it. They all have a party.
We can be sipping on our mimosas at 10 a.m. like the woman in the book. After gym.
Yes, before spa.
Before spa. I'm here for it. But I think this is just to say that this is a book that we haven't really, a genre that we haven't really explored at the Cheeky Natives. And it really sort of forced us to read outside of our comfort zone and to ask ourselves some really uncomfortable questions. You know, why we felt pressed by Owen or Courtney or Lily. But also just that the themes are so universal that even as two Black Joburgers sitting reading this book, we could relate to a lot of the feelings that Lily and that Owen were experiencing, and that it forced us to have some intimate conversations with ourselves, right, about what we think the gulf is between people who live in these gated bubbles and our lived experience, and sort of the commonalities that exist in all sorts of human experience. And I think you did such an amazing job of doing that in this book.
Thank you.
So we're quite excited to see what Shelley's doing. I can't wait to see what Shelley's doing.
I've had such a great conversation with you. I don't think I've ever experienced having two people understand and evaluate and be so critical and at the same time completely understood the characters that I wrote in this book. So it's been an absolute privilege.
Thank you so much. And I think something that we tend to do and want to create at the Cheeky Natives is the idea of critically engaging with literature. I think that there has been a really surface level of engagement with literature, and particularly like, oh, we read a book and we're like, yeah, I enjoyed it, but not to talk about the thematics that the book covers, right? So this is part of why we started the Cheeky Natives. I mean, I would spend hours on the phone talking about a book and then being like, oh my gosh, like, wait, maybe we should actually speak to authors about their books and be like, this is what we think we read in the book, this is our feelings about the book, and share, you know, grapple and work yeah. through the work with you.
And the realization that you don't have to be in the arts to have an appreciation for literature, that you can be completely outside of it, but be able to critically analyze and appreciate the work, because I think that will go a long way towards creating a culture that has an appreciation for the work that is art. Because, like, art is craft, you know, like, writing a book is not, hey, I'm sitting chilling with my friends, and then I wrote this book. There's work that goes into it, and I think when you engage with work deeply, you begin to appreciate the craft. Because, I mean, the fact that we were able to walk out of this and like, have our own rethinking of what it means to be a mixed-race man in Clifton, you know, is testament to the craft that's been put into the book.
I really appreciate you saying that, because it is the first time that I've sat down with anyone and had such an in-depth conversation about the characters in it. And it's also challenged me to think about, well, what was I intending with it? Because there was an intention, but it's kind of that thing that sits in the back of my head, and not always, sometimes it's just a feeling. And then when you have the conversation with somebody to articulate it, it's quite an interesting process. So I really appreciate what you've done and all the effort that you've put into understanding these characters.
And
it's
so
been fantastic.
I mean, where do people get a hold of you? Do you have Twitter?
I am on Twitter. I'm also on Instagram. And I mean, I'm not that hard to find.
What are your handles?
It's QLED, QLED is Twitter, and Instagram is just Carnita. And if you get really desperate, I'm also on Facebook.
If you get really desperate.
So please go out and buy the book. We just want to encourage everybody to go out and buy the book. Please don't ask the author for a free book.
I don't have any free ones.
Or a PDF, because we've seen some shocking things on social media and we're calling them out. It's important to support the literature of people of color. It drives the industry. It creates a bigger platform so that the next time you have a book out, You have a platform to speak from, you know, you have like a market, there have been people who've bought your book, and it makes it easier for the next time someone who looks like Carnita, who wants to publish your
book. Also makes it easier for publishers, because, you know, they're in the business of selling books.
Exactly,
Please buy books, guys. Please don't borrow your friend's book. don't do like a traveling library, buy the book. I think it's really important. We always have conversations about traveling libraries and how all 20 of us will read a book, but it's one copy, because I've lent it to you, you've lent it to somebody else. So if you're particularly moved by a book, buy it for your friend, or just encourage them to buy the book. They can go to Bridge Books and use Cheeky as a code and get 10% off.
Yes.
So don't say we never did anything for you.
Yes. All right. Thank you very much for joining us on this episode of the Cheeky Natives. Until next time.
Bye.